investigating truth in a world of lies. You are listening to the John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
I am very pleased to welcome into the Anomic Age Mr. Dan Happel. Dan is a fourth generation Montanan, born and raised in the Gallatin Valley. Dan is a retired businessman living on a ranch near Pony, Montana, with his wife Ingrid, has three children and four grandchildren, of whom he is especially proud. Dan graduated summa cum laude in architectural technology from Western Technological College, and after graduation, volunteered for the draft and served as an architect in training to the Distinct Facilities Engineer Headquarters Company, U.S. Army at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C., from 1971 through 1973. Dan has traveled extensively and is a frequent speaker on a number of crucial, important, and controversial subjects. UN Agenda 21, the history of progressive socialism in America, money, banking, and the Federal Reserve System, and life, liberty, and poverty, the cornerstones of freedom. Having developed several highly regarded PowerPoint programs on these subjects, Dan also teaches U.S. constitutional classes for various groups around Montana and has provided technical assistance on legislative bills for a number of Montana state legislators for the past 8 years. Providing well-researched information and education that emphasizes liberty and the true meaning of American dream will attract freedom-loving Americans to our cause and can help restore America, stated Dan. Dan Happel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, John. And I have to tell you, it's a particular pleasure to be on your program. I've had some contact with you earlier, and I appreciate the fact that you are one of the few people in an alternative media even that really want to talk about the subject of UN Agenda 21, 2030. And that's an area in my life of particular interest because, frankly, if it's completely adapted and adopted as presented by the UN, our lifestyles in the United States will be totally different, and we will be living under a totalitarian, technocratic UN dictatorship that will take all of the freedoms that we've known as Americans and throw them in the ash can of history. So it's important that people understand just exactly what UN Agenda 21 is and what an enormous impact it's going to have on our nation and on the entire world, because it will affect everything about our world and every freedom that we have.
Yeah, that's the absolute truth. It's pretty scary. I always kind of come back to this point. I think the quote-unquote powers that be, or the global elites or whatever they'd like to be called, definitely want a global feudalism. They want this sort of Hunger Games scenario where it's just that 0.1% at the top, and everyone else is just living in squalor. And I don't think people grasp the severity of what's coming down the pike here with Agenda 21/30 if we don't make some changes.
Well, that's right, John. And the thing that people miss, and this is the something of the right-left paradigm that most of the people on the left don't really understand. We should all be about freedom. We should all be about the rights of the individual. And the people on the left who are selling to collectivism, they don't, most of them are well-meaning, and they don't really understand what they're selling. What they're selling is a top-down dictatorship, a top-down technocratic society where a few people at the very top decide everything for the rest of us. And yet those same people on the left are constantly talking about the rights of the individual, about, you know, they talk about racism and sexism and all the isms that they are supposedly trying to protect and thwart the you know, the opposition. They accuse everybody of being Nazis. Well, Nazis are National Socialists. So in reality, what they're promoting is exactly what they say they're against. And an awful lot of people on the left just don't get it. They just flat don't get it. And those of us who believe in freedom, who believe in our Constitution and the rights of the individual under the Constitution, we understand that if the rights of the individual are destroyed for the rights of the collective, if we have no individual liberty, we will not have collective liberty either, because bottom line, if you can't decide your own future, if you don't have any information or any ability to control what happens in your life, and all you are is just a puppet of the state, you have nothing. You have no freedom at all, and you will end up being one very unhappy slave. And that's just the whole truth of it.
Yeah, for some reason, I think a lot of the folks on the left don't seem to connect the Nazi dots to the right places. I had a very early on guest, Mr. Mark Musser, who was, still is, a pastor, and he's moved his whole family. He's living in Europe now. But he's done several books on the connections between the Green Movement and the Nazi ideology. And ironically enough, that was one of my first videos that got a lot of flack, and they eventually pulled it off YouTube because they were trying to say, well, he was espousing Nazism. And I was thinking, you guys must not have heard the interview, because he was just connecting the dots between the Nazis and a lot of their theorists and ideologies, and said, hey, there's the line. It connects right up to the Green Movement or the Green New Deal or Agenda 21 or 30 or, you know, whatever new lipstick they're wanting to put on the pig there.
Yeah, I have that. I believe I have that book that if he's the author of the book, I think it's called Nazi Oaks or something like that. But
yeah.
I have that book, and he's hit it spot on. If you want to go back and you want to really understand the beginning of the environmental movement in the world, it started in Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler was a rabid environmentalist. He was also a eugenicist and a lot of other things that are tied to the radical left movement. And they just, you know, they don't even know their own history. So what we really need to do, we need to forget the left-right paradigm. We need to do things that improve the lives of everyone in the world. And we need something that promotes and protects human liberty to the point where people can start crawling out of all the I guess I would call it despotic places in the world that have held them back. Human dignity and human ingenuity is a key for the success of the world. And, you know, they talk about overpopulation. Populations increase in areas where there's a limited education, limited understanding, limited ability to, let's say, take care of your family. And they go down in areas where you have a higher level of education. People understand that there probably at some point is a limit to the carrying capacity of the planet. But the idea is that we make the people smarter and more capable, and we will solve all of our issues with human ingenuity. We've done it in the past. The United States is probably the greatest beacon in the world for freedom, or at least it was. And it was also the greatest environmental stewardship movement in the world, because actually produce the amount of wealth to improve our environment, where the other countries around the world are the polluters of the world. And the United States, you have to have wealth to be able to do things to improve the environment and to improve the world. So bottom line, you destroy individualism, you destroy wealth, you're going to be creating more of the same problem, not solving it.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely the fact. I mean, people seem to somehow forget that China is probably the greatest polluter of all time over there with rivers on fire and pretty much no environmental constraints whatsoever. I mean, the people in the apple factories jumping off the roofs, all kinds of horrendous animal abuses and so forth.
Right, right. Well, John, I have to tell you, this is the part that bothers me more than anything else. UN Agenda 21 is being promoted by the UN hierarchy. And guess what? Red China, Communist China, is the number one favorite poster child of the UN. They love communism, even though, you're right, China pollutes much more than the United States right now. Their pollution isn't just CO2, which is actually good for the environment. Their pollution is nitrous oxide. It's all the heavy metals and all the nasty things that come from a totally unregulated environmental nightmare in the middle of an industrialized nation that has no regard for the environment. I don't get it. I don't know why the UN would be promoting a country that has such a horrible environmental record, other than the fact that I guess we all recognize that UN Agenda 21, 2030, it's all about converting the world to communism under a technocratic system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why they like them. Can I tell your listeners what I'd like to do? I'd like to give them an idea of just exactly what some of the primary talking points of what UN Agenda 21 is and why it is a plan to change the world into, as they call it, a more sustainable place by 2030.
Sure.
Okay, let's take a look at what they find as offensive and unsustainable that needs to be eliminated. Number one on the list is all private property rights, property ownership. Under UN Agenda 21, the rights to own property will be eliminated. Number two on their list, all forms of irrigation, chemical pesticides, fertilizers, weed control, anything to do with chemicals in agriculture will be eliminated. Number three, all forms of livestock production. The elimination of meat from your diet, we will become a vegetarian world, and they want to eliminate all forms of meat consumption except for the very privileged who they plan to be, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Number four on the list, all privately owned vehicles and personal travel. That will be eliminated. They will eliminate also airline flights unless it's for their people. Air travel will be eliminated. All private vehicles of every kind will be living on public transportation, and I'll explain that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
All forms of fossil fuels for the production of electricity or mechanized travel will be eliminated. We'll be living in their so-called sustainable, renewable energy world, which is ridiculous because the solar panels and the wind farms that they want to use are only efficient part of the time. They're not efficient all the time. And incidentally, they use a tremendous amount of material to manufacture those things. So next on the list, and this is something that you're seeing played out right now in the United States. All personal rights to the possession of handguns, rifles, and firearms. They will completely disarm the American people. Your Second Amendment rights will be completely gone. Next on the list, all dams, ski lodges, golf courses, vacation resorts, anything to do with recreational activities they feel are unsustainable and need to be eliminated. And with those dams that they plan to eliminate, and they say that it's necessary because they're inhibiting the natural migration of fish and aquatic species, and therefore these dams need to be eliminated. Right now in the United States, they've targeted over 6,000 dams that will be eliminated. And with that, one of the most reliable and infinitely renewable sources of electricity, and that's hydroelectric power. When they eliminate the dams, they will eliminate the ability to produce electricity to go with them. Next on the list, all single-family homes, ranches, farms, and dwellings will be eliminated, and we will be moved into a stack-and-pack megacity that will be surrounded by wilderness area, and we will literally, as Dr. Michael Kaufman said at one time, we will be part of the collective system known as the human kennel. We will be in the cages. The animals will be on the outside. Next on the list is mineral extraction and timber harvesting and any use of natural resources that are not specifically approved by the UN and by the people who will be controlling everything. And last but not least on the list is, and this is something people need to understand, they're dead serious about this. They've written it in many of their publications. They believe that the maximum worldwide population of humans must be reduced to fewer than a billion people. Well, that means we're going to be eliminating more than 6 billion people. And people say, well, how could they possibly do that? Well, they can do that because if they control the food supply, they control everything about the environment, everything around you, and you have no property rights, and you have no Second Amendment rights, you're pretty much toast. You're pretty much at their beck and call. And so they can choose who is going to be allowed to live, and I guarantee you anybody that believes in freedom won't be in that group.
That's the truth.
Well, I'll tell you, people need to understand just exactly how serious these people are. And there is a number of publications that are out there that people need to read. They need to understand the UN Biodiversity Treaty. That is based on a publication that was produced by the UN, and it is 1,200 and some pages. And it talks about all the things that we just mentioned over the last 5 minutes on the things that they plan to eliminate. And they put it in a very, very technical, very difficult to read. But if you sort through, you pile through all the information in there, it says exactly what I just stated, is what they plan to do to the planet. And they really truly believe that they are saving Gaia or Mother Earth, you know, for pagans, and they believe that the only way they can save Mother Earth is by destroying human society and our freedom. So we'll just leave that. I have to tell you, there's a lot going on, and we need to be very, very aware of how the radical environmental movement is promoting all this UN Agenda 21 stuff. So we'll cover that.
And just to buttress your points here a little bit, you know, all this is totally indoctrinated. K through 12, I always say, is indoctrination, college, university, weaponization. So the UNESCO Foundation, you know, look at UNESCO. It's got its tentacles all over academia. And then you've got the UNESCO World Heritage Sites, where they're basically buying up all these, you know, huge Native American monuments or any sort of like the Grand Canyon or Teotihuacan, Tenochtitlan. All over the world, they're buying up these huge, you know, historical treasures. So that's all under UN control. And then you got UNESCO with the indoctrination. So, of course, it spits out perfect little drones that are going, oh, yeah, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. You know, we're all doomed unless we start riding our fixed geared bikes and eating dirt. You know, I mean, I sort of laugh, but it's really a legitimate thing that's going on here.
Well, John, it is. And I mean, you can go to virtually any national park in the country, and somewhere in their office, you'll find a plaque that says that it is part of a UN World Heritage Site.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
You know, that's exactly what you're talking about. We no longer are sovereigns over our own nation. We're actually servants of a system that is controlled by the United Nations.
Yeah. I mean, what people don't seem to get is that's not the United States. You know, that's a total outside entity. They tried to kick this in with the League of Nations in World War II and then finally got it into the UN post-World War II. They tried it in League of Nations World War I. But, you know, the same point is, it's nothing to do with the United States, people.
No, it isn't. And these people have had control of our country for longer than we realized. I mean, you talk about the education system. What's happened to our education system is an absolute travesty. It started 200 years ago, but it was accelerated under John Dewey, and it was now our education system under Common Core teaches absolutely nothing about, you know, let's say science and history and all the things that we used to think were important. They teach people how to work together and how to work under a collective and how to, you know, work together and be good workers. It's all about work, 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 and being workers, and has nothing to do with the quality of life or nothing to do with real, true education. It has everything to do with teaching people to be part of the collectivist system. And you mentioned how that's happened, but over the last 80 to 100 years, we've had an amazing shift in our country and the way we approach the education of our children, and it's all been negative. We spend more money than any other country in the world, yet we have per capita, I should say, for our students, and at the same time, we've got one of the lowest scores on all the standard testing material in the developed world. And that's happened really in our lifetimes, John. Since I was a kid, it has changed so much that it doesn't even look like the same country, really.
Oh, it's completely insane. It's really just depressing. When you first started talking, I was sort of noting you said sustainability, and that's always in my list of weird buzzwords that the communists push throughout education. I mean, if you go to any college, university, high school, what have you, I guarantee you, you'll see those same buzzwords in the literature, in the lessons, in the PowerPoints, in everything. It's sustainability, diversity, globalism, global citizen. I mean, there's a lot more, but you get the broad strokes there, and it's all pushing that same thing. And it is pushing that be a good worker, I believe it was over Auschwitz, it said freedom through work or something to that effect, over the gates. You know, it's yep. People are missing these same things, are repeating. They're just sort of slightly changing the packaging just a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you talked about the words that are part of the sustainability movement, part of the college campuses, and also in the, you know, the grade schools, clear down to kindergarten. There are a number of words that have developed over the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years that are part of our standard vernacular now. And 20, 30 years ago, you hardly ever heard of these terms. And I'm going to give you just a short list of some of the things that, and think about it, you didn't hear these terms 30 years ago. New economy, equity, consensus, affordable housing, friends of, preservation of life, benefit of all, quality of life, sanctuary, social justice, facilitators, traffic calming, best management practices, private-public partnerships, outcome-based education, endangered species, invasive species, public-private partnerships, again, common good, regionalism, collective collaboration, interdisciplinary, stakeholders. All these words that we hear now that are part of our standard vernacular, words that didn't even, you know, I mean, the words existed, but we didn't use them in our daily conversations. You know, you'd rarely even hear these words. Now they are the focus of our words, of our speech, of our ideas. They're at the center of all of it.
Yeah, it absolutely is the truth. I mean, you know, the linguistics is there, and that old adage, perception is reality. I mean, that's pretty true. If you bombard people with these linguistic cues long enough, they'll start to believe that perception is reality and that the sky is falling. It's just so hard to digest. I mean, I'm only 41, but I remember when I was a kid in the 80s, there was a television show and then a little magazine called 321 Contact. And I remember this very well. You know, it's odd the things you kind of remember and forget, but I remember this for some reason. You know, I got one of these little monthly magazines and I was reading it. I think it was probably 7 or 8 or something, but it was the first time that, at least in my mind's eye, I recollect anything about the warming of the atmosphere. I'm trying to think of the word, the greenhouse effect. That's what they were going with then. And I remember reading this magazine, and I was freaked out. And I was trying to talk to my mom about it. I was like, what's going on? You're like, are we going to all die? Like, I was freaked out. I was like 7 or 8 or something. But, you know, I mean, juxtapose that to now where, I mean, kids get inundated with that from basically preschool on, and you can only imagine the psychological ramifications these kids are getting brainwashed with.
You know, John, I have to tell you, that is, and it's such a false narrative. I mean, it really is. Dr. Tim Ball is a friend of mine, and he's been on my radio show a number of times. And incidentally, I do a radio program called Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. Part of the conversations I've had with Tim Ball over the last number of years is about the hockey stick. Michael Mann is the guy that created the hockey stick for Al Gore. And under the hockey stick, it says that right now, we are at the hottest time, the hottest climate that the earth has ever had, okay, which is complete crap. And certainly in man's history, the warmest time ever. Well, in truth, if you don't destroy the medieval warm period and the Roman classical period and several other warm areas, then, yeah, it's the warmest it's been in, I don't know, 3,000 years, something like that, if you destroy those. But if you leave those in the context, they were growing grapes in Greenland and farming in Greenland back in the 11th and 12th century. And the climate was much warmer. And the fact is that the climate in Greenland now, those areas that are covered with ice at one time were being farmed. So we've had a lot of warmer periods in Earth's history. And we are at a very depleted time in history for CO2. We're at one of the lowest levels of CO2 in world history, and I'm talking about geological time. We are at one of the lowest CO2 levels that we've ever had in the Earth's history. In the past, we've had as much as 7 and 8 times higher CO2 levels than we have today. And in those times, the Earth was thriving, because the reality is CO2 is the gas of life. It's not a poisonous gas.
Exactly.
It is what plants thrive on. And guess what happens when plants thrive and they have higher CO2? They do much better, they grow much better, and they use less water. I mean, it's a perfect combination, and that's why they pump CO2 into greenhouses when they're trying to start all these plants in greenhouses. They increase the CO2 level in the greenhouses because they do so much better. And the other side of that, what do plants produce that humans want? Well, guess what? They produce oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And we are at one of the lowest oxygen levels right now in world history in geological terms. And with that, human life doesn't do as well. The human beings do much better in higher oxygen levels. They grow bigger, stronger. They are more capable of clear thought and everything else. So the reality is the people that are promoting the reduction of their so-called greenhouse gases, which they don't include water vapor in their greenhouse gases, which make up about 95% of all the greenhouse gases, or water vapor. They are trying to reduce things that make life on Earth actually better. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, John. These people, I mean, there's no science behind any of this. And I have to tell you, Michael Mann sued Tim Ball, because Tim Ball, in one of his public forums, said that Michael Mann, instead of teaching at Penn State, he should be teaching at the state Penn because of the faulty science behind his hockey stick. Well, Michael Mann sued Tim Ball in Canadian court, and about a month ago, the court came back and told Michael Mann that he needed to, he was found completely, let's say, without merit. His case was completely without merit, and he was ordered to pay all of Tim Ball's court costs. Now, you won't read that on the mainstream media.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I didn't read that. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. No, Tim won the case clearly, and here's how he won it. He told the court, he said, fine, if he says that I'm wrong and that I'm besmirching his character, he said, I would be the very first to admit that I'm wrong. I want to see his proof of how he came up with the theory that we're in the warmest times ever. I need to see the scientific papers that back that up. And Mann refused to produce those papers because he can't, mm-hmm. You know. I mean, he just can't do it. His science is complete nonsense. There's no science there. And for a guy like Al Gore to go before the American people and say, the arguments are over, the time for talk is over, the science is settled. Well, guess what? There's not a single scientist in the world that believes that kind of nonsense, because the reality is Science is never settled. You're always trying to retest all the ideas that create the scientific paradigm.
Yes.
And if you can't prove it and you can't continue to prove it, then the science is faulty. And that is the basis of good science, is to continually test and retest those theses. So for a guy like Al Gore to say, you know, the debate's over, we don't need to talk about it anymore, is complete crap.
Yes. Thank you so much for stating that, Dan. That is the obvious fact, the prima facie that I don't see how most academicians fail to perceive. I mean, you got to follow the scientific method, and the whole point is to be able to replicate this process, substantiate it with data, and there's really no end of the road here. I mean, if new research comes up, it compels you to retest it again, and I mean, come on. It's just...
Absolutely. That's the whole basis of science. And when we get to the point where we say we know it all and there's no way that we can continue to retest our ideas, then we've hit a road of no return, because the reality is everything is constantly changing in science.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, take a look at Einstein's relativity theory and now quantum physics and some of the things that have changed over the last, you know, 20, 30, 50, 80 years. I mean, it's constantly, we're constantly proving that old ideas are not right and that new ideas may be more correct. And that's part of, as you say, the scientific process. That's part of how it all works. So, pretty amazing. I you know, and I have to tell you that the IPCC, I'm sure your listeners may know this, but they may not. Of the so-called 2,000 scientists, actually there's a little over 2,000 scientists that signed on to the IPCC report on climate change that was the basis of all the stuff that they're promoting right now. In fact, most of them were not scientists at all. They were researchers, or they were environmentalists, or they were ecologists, but they weren't scientists. And a very large number of the scientists that actually produced the work that went into the IPCC report, their work showed that man wasn't responsible for climate change, but their parts of it were dropped out, but their names were kept on the list. And many of them have protested because the report that was produced was something totally the opposite of what they actually reported when they put together the research. So this is the kind of thing that's going on in the scientific community. And I have to tell you, there's some 20,000 U.S. Scientists that have signed a petition that they don't believe anthropogenic global warming is the problem that's being promoted by the UN.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder how many botanists and geologists are falling for this global warming thing. I would kind of assume not too many. Because to borrow your phrase, to connect the dots here, I mean, the botanists are just like anybody in a greenhouse knows we have this perfect symbiotic relationship where we need the oxygen, we expel the carbon dioxide. I mean, the plants use that in their process and create oxygen. I mean, it's a perfect creation here.
It is. It is. And it goes beyond science. It really does go beyond science. It goes into spiritualism. It goes into, you know, most of us would refer to as the underpinnings of, well, certainly Christianity, but even other religions, that, you know, that man is here as a steward, and that nature's God has created the universe and all the parts in it, and we are a very, very small part of that whole process. We can pollute, you know, which is obvious by countries like China, that are really polluting like crazy. I'll mention this. You know that big area in the South Pacific that is supposedly filled full of junk and plastic that's floating around and killing all the birds and causing all these problems that they're talking about in the environment. Guess where 85% of the stuff that's floating around in there come from?
I'm going to have to guess China.
China and Southeast Asia. Very, very small percentage of that comes from the United States. And you know, there's stuff from a lot of countries. But let's just assume that, you know, the pollution is as big a problem as they say it is. And I think it is, actually. I think it's a problem. Why in the world aren't they going after the countries that are doing the lion's share of the polluting? Why are they going after the United States constantly? And I can tell you, it's the bottom line on Agenda 21. We're the only country that believes in the rights of the individual and private property and in a free market system that's based on a capitalistic idea. And the rest of these countries are one form of socialism or another, and they protect that because, after all, that's what they want. They want socialism. And so they don't talk about China being this gigantic polluter. I've got pictures, you've seen them, of you know, the chemical factories and stuff in China. You can't believe the kind of horrible smoke and pollution coming off of these things. No one has done anything like that in the United States for probably at least a half a century. You know, so if they don't like pollution, they better go after the polluters and not try to destroy the producers that believe in environmental regulation.
Yeah, I mean, that's saying nothing to the Fukushima thing, which I'm assuming is still going on. It sort of fell off the proverbial radar. I mean, it was the in vogue story for about a month, and then I guess we're supposed to believe miraculously everything is back to normal. I don't know.
Yeah, in fact, the air and the oceans are suffering right now from all the effects of Fukushima, and they've not been mitigated. They've not been taken care of, and it is an ongoing problem. And all I can say is that it's all a money game, John. It's all about control. It's about power. It's about money. They all go back to the same thing, and it's been that's been the story for who knows since humanity began. I guess it's all about power, money, and control.
Wow, it certainly does seem to be the case.
Yeah, it does. Well, listen, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Agenda 21 if you want to hear.
Yes, I didn't mean to derail you a bit.
Well, it's you know, it's funny because we get these terms that keep being repeated to us over and over and over again, and there's three terms that are, they call it the primary objectives of the UN Agenda 21, and they have an overlapping of purpose. And if you draw three great big circles that overlap one another, and they call it equity, economy, and the environment. They say they're all tied. That is the fundamental program for UN Agenda 21 is dealing with equity, with the economy, and with the environment. And so let's see what those really mean within the UN Agenda 21 framework. Equity means using the law and government to restructure and modify human nature. It allows special interests to use the police powers of the state to force compliance with laws that are antithetical to constitutional law, things that are antithetical to what our whole system of government is based on. It allows educators and social engineers to stifle individualism, personal responsibility, and self-reliance, and promotes a complete shift in attitudes through public education and social justice indoctrination to what they call a more just and equitable world, where communalism is good and self-interest and capitalism is redefined as greed. That's at the center of this. This mindset substitutes social justice redistribution for equal justice, which is our equal rights under the law. And that's the foundation of the American system. And it destroys the concept of unalienable rights under the law. The youth are taught that they are global citizens, not Americans, and educators are unwittingly teaching the views and dictates of socialist global planners through programs like Goals 2000, No Child Left Behind, and Common Core. Those programs are all modeled from UNESCO's global program, Education for All. It's called EFA. So Common Core and all these things have a basis that's tied completely into the whole program of UN Agenda 21. So let's look at the second factor, which is economy. They're talking about how equity and economy and the environment all work together to create this perfect world that they believe will exist under UN Agenda 21. Okay, well, the economy, the definition for economy, according to UN Agenda 21, is the transfer of wealth from developed countries to underdeveloped or developing countries. The authors of Agenda 21 use a Marxist-socialist worldview that always assumes that life is a zero-sum game where the creation of wealth can only come at the expense of others less fortunate that are living in third world or exploited countries. It's all about redistribution of wealth. The monetary systems of sovereign nations must be collapsed, reorganized, and merged into a world financial system controlled by a cartel of international banking elites and their cadre of central bank planners. Under this one world financial system, all human activity can be closely monitored and tightly controlled. Digital financial transactions, which will replace cash and national currencies, will rapidly evolve into a cashless society where an electronic device implanted in a card or under your skin will be scanned and electronically entered into a database that will record all of your transactions. Anyone, like you or like me, John, that fails to comply with regulations or exhibits an attitude of resistance may, or more likely will, have their transactions denied and will either comply with their system or they'll starve to death. And I've got a quote here by David Rockefeller that I use on my Agenda 21 programs. I'd like to be able to repeat this for your listeners. It says, and this is a quote, "We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and the other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promise of discretion for almost 40 years." This was back in, I think, 1991 that he did this speech. "It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government, the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries." That national, and that's unquote. And that national autodetermination, John, that he was talking about, mm-hmm. is our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. It's government, sovereign government by nation states. And this was reported at the 1991 Bilderberger Conference. This was a speech that he made at that conference. And it's been widely reported a number of times. So that's what economy is all about when you're talking equity, Equity is conditioning our kids to believe in this one world collectivist system. Economy is using the banking and financial systems of the country to create a one world government. Now let's take a look at what that third term, that third circle in the UN Agenda 21 policy is all about, and that is the environment. Okay, under the UN plan, the environment will be used as a tool to promote political ideas and agendas that would otherwise be so wildly unpopular that they would have no chance of being implemented. Through various smart growth, zoning regulation, wilderness bills, wildlands, and endangered species initiatives, private property can become increasingly controlled and eventually eliminated. Unelected stakeholders and our councils are organized to give local governments a consensus or a vision statement for their communities. Now, I have to tell you, I've seen this firsthand. I am a former county commissioner. I have seen the planners and the so-called stakeholders come in and, or facilitators, I'm sorry, the facilitators come in and run these meetings. That's exactly what they do. So anyway, under these environmental groups, they are in effect transferring individual property rights to a collective system where all property is tightly controlled by a central planning authority. A regional, national, or internationally sanctioned tax-exempt NGO is usually behind these efforts and acts as a facilitator to steer the stakeholders to a predetermined conclusion. In other words, land use laws become progressively more restrictive, more expensive to implement, and difficult to litigate until property owners finally just give up or sell off their property rights. And that's what is really behind this movement where they sell their property rights to an environmental group under a I can't think the name of it. I'm missing the point on this one. But anyway, they do it under a restrictive easement. There we go.
Okay.
A environmental easement. That's what that whole thing is all about. So you know, it's using Delphi technique with all these planning groups to go in and convince people that they don't know how to use their own land, that the NGOs are the smart ones, the local planners or the national organizations have all this expertise, and therefore they need to turn all their property rights over to these other groups. That's what it's all about. And I saw it firsthand in my county in southwest Montana, because our county planner just happened to be the president of the state Montana Planning Association and happened to be a huge promoter of the American Planning Association, which is behind a lot of this Agenda 21 stuff. And she was trying to convince people that they needed to move out of the country. They need to create all these wildlife corridors, and they need to restrict where they live and move into more tightly controlled communities. So this happens, and it's part of that whole process. So that's how the three E's work together, John. They literally overlap, and the sweet spot is when someone else controls every one of your rights, and you have no say over anything about where you live or where you work or anything else, and it's all controlled by a central authority. That's UN Agenda 21.
Yeah, I pulled up the diagram. I think I'm looking at the same one you are, or you were talking about there with environmental, social, and economic. That Venn diagram, I believe.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it's how they you know, they even draw it up in their own circles that this overlapping is a very important part of this. And I have to tell you that, this planning, I mean, let's face it, most Americans think that somebody's got all these degrees or has all these credentials are much smarter than they are. And the fact is that I think we've probably seen this. There are some great academians out there, but there are also some that, have some of the screwiest ideas in the world. And I have to tell you, I have a retired college professor that lives in our area, and he's a nice guy. Don't get me wrong. He's a really good guy. But when I did my program on Agenda 21, he said, well, I know that I know much more about environmentalism than you do. I'm a college professor.
Of course.
And I said, okay, what exactly did you get your degree in that you have all these credentials? Well, it turns out he teaches 17th and 18th century English poetry, and that's what he got his degree in.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how that equates into a huge knowledge of the environment, but he and his wife are still walking to town to keep their carbon footprint in a minimum, and all I can think is, you goofy fool, why in the world?
Good grief.
Yeah.
Man, that's so sad.
It is. It's sad. It's sad. It's too bad. But, you know, the reality is that you may have an enormous amount of knowledge as a result of a great education, but you may also, be just kind of using a false credential to promote ideas that you have really no knowledge about. And we've tried to actually promote a debate at the local university here on climate change. I've got all these great people that would love to come and challenge this, and they don't want to do it. You know, what they tell you is that, oh, the science is settled. We don't need to debate it. We know what we're talking about. You don't, you know. There you go.
That's the science is settled. That's the hallmark of academia now. That's a comedy.
Yeah, it is. It's a comedy. And I have a quote here that was in Range magazine some years ago. But the IPCC, which is the International Panel on Climate Change, that the UN did at Anglia University, that was the center of the whole climate change, the focus of the climate change pro-anthropogenic global warming paper is the IPCC.
Okay.
This is a quote from the IPCC lead author, whose name is Dr. Otmar Edenhofer, and this was on November 13th in 2010 that he made this quote. Redistribute de facto the world's wealth by climate policy. One has to free oneself from the illusion that international climate policy is environmental policy. This has almost nothing to do with environmental policy anymore, unquote. So in other words, the redistribution of wealth is what this whole report is all about. It has nothing to do with environmental policy. Well, why in the world are we selling it as environmental policy if that's the case? It's just crazy.
Mm-hmm. Seems like, kind of like you were saying, they're using the environmental policy as their Trojan horse to really push an economic sanctions policy to, remove the Constitution, remove Magna Carta, and just put people in a global feudalism. I mean, that's...
Yeah, just move them into their human kennels that they foresee. And incidentally, the movies, the what the heck do they call them? The movie that they just did. It's like a 4-part movie.
Oh, The Hunger Games is the one I was
thinking
of.
The Hunger Games.
Yeah, that's
absolutely. The Hunger
what
Games.
What they want.
Are really based on a lot of the stuff that's coming out of the environmental movement.
Mm-hmm.
It makes an awful lot of sense. The Hunger Games, I think everyone should take a look at those movies, because the reality of what UN Agenda 21-2030 is about would probably be a lot more like the reality in those Hunger Game movies than it would be the world that we live in today. Just pretty much that simple. There's another Christiana Figueres. She's a big figure at the UN. I think at some point they have her planned as being the senior fellow at the UN, the secretary general, as it were, of the UN. And right now she is executive director of the UN Climate Change Conventions, UNFCCC. And she made a quote at Qatar in 2012, and I'd like your listeners to hear that quote. Quote, mm-hmm. "It must be understood that what is occurring here, not just in Doha, but in the whole climate change process, is a complete transformation of the economic structure of the world. A centralized transformation that is going to make the life of everyone on the planet very different," unquote. Now, that centralized, if we understand the term centralization, we also know that that stands for communalization or communism.
Yeah.
The fact is that they want to move us into a one world, technocratic, socialist / communist government that's controlled by a handful of people.
That's exactly it. I mean, I see the Hunger Games scenario as their exact model. I mean, that's exactly what they want.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, people need to, just think about this. And I'm going to give them a list of different programs that are part of our national fabric now. And think about how closely they fit the Agenda 21 ideas, the policies under UN Agenda 21.
Mm-hmm.
The Wildlands Project. Everybody has heard of the Wildlands Project. Well, if you take a look at the Wildlands map, it shows most of North America as being wilderness area, being off limits to human use. That's part of the Wildlands Project. The Clean Water Act, which it was being expanded to all waters of the U.S., but under President Trump, it looks like we're maybe going to have a little reprieve, but we better make sure that we keep going in the direction to reduce all those water regulations. And don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about reducing pollution. I'm talking about reducing the scope or the definition of the Clean Water Act, because it was always intended to be in navigable waters,
mm-hmm.
Rivers and big areas. It was never intended to be, smaller streams and things like that. But now, under the definition that were put in place under the Obama administration, literally every area that may even have a puddle, may even get rain on it. In other words, every square inch of our country would fall under the Clean Water Act. So that's part of that. The Clean Air Act, we've heard of the Clean Air Act, and obviously that's part of it as well. We've got numerous wilderness bills that are being pushed through Congress constantly. Those wilderness bills are all part of UN Agenda 21. The Antiquities and the National Monuments Acts, and you alluded to this earlier in the conversation, those are all part of UN Agenda 21. The National Grasslands Act, that's this prairie initiative that's being promoted right now. in communism, it is communism, the Dakotas, in Nebraska, in Kansas, and in Montana and Wyoming. That's all part of the National Grassland Act, and under that, literally whole huge areas of all those states will become part of a free-roaming bison area and completely unfenced and wide open, and will become off-limits for most human activity. So that's a big deal. The Endangered Species Act, they've used that as a club to beat us into submission over things like wolves and grizzly bears, and now they're trying to do it with sage grouse and all these other things. I think we all remember the spotted owl and how they use that to shut down the timber industry in much of the Northwest. So that's what they got planned for that. The interconnecting wildlife corridors that we see in all, literally all rural planning efforts include interconnecting wildlife corridors. And if you don't believe that, go to your planning department in your local, either your city or especially in your county, and ask them about the interconnecting wildlife corridors that are part of their planning process. And I guarantee you, you'll find them virtually everywhere. The Yucatan to Yukon initiative is called Y2Y. But they changed it because there was such an outcry about it being such a huge program. But it was originally intended to be all the way from the Yucatan Peninsula all the way through North America, clear to the Arctic Circle. They changed it because there was such an outcry. So now it's the Yellowstone to Yukon that they call it. But if you go back to the Wildlands Project's maps that were there in the early 90s, you'll see that it was Yucatan to Yukon. So Y2Y has a lot of impact. The North American Biodiversity Treaty, that's part of this. Conservation easements nationwide, they're part of this program, because if they can control how you use your land through conservation easements, eventually they'll own your land.
That's the truth.
Yep, it really is, because, you know, a lot of these farmers that have signed up for these conservation easements because they could get a few dollars out of it or get a, a tax write-off, a lot of them are now finding out that these are irrevocable. And the thing that people need to understand about conservation easements, it's stated right in every one of them that they are all subject to change in government regulations. Well, the same people who are promoting conservation easements, all these environmental groups, are meanwhile lobbying Congress to increase the amount of regulation on all private land. So what's happening is these people are buying time to actually get all these programs in place that shut down the ability for rural Americans to be able to use their land in any productive way. So what it boils down to is that they'll pay, let's say, pennies on the dollar. Let's say typically 30 or 40 cents on the dollar for a conservation easement on somebody's land, and then start increasing the regulation through government agencies. Eventually, that land is completely useless to the farmers or ranchers that are on that land, and they literally end up selling their whole place for pennies on the dollar, and they just walk away because they can't do anything with their land except pay taxes on it. And so it's a really, really insidious program. It's nasty as can be. And people need to understand that before they get into a conservation easement. And I tell people, ask the people that are selling that conservation easement if they will write that contract in a way that allows you to revisit and rethink and walk away from that easement in, let's say, 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
If you don't like it. And I guarantee you, they will not write a contract like that. You know, this is a long-term plan, and they have it well thought out. So, we've got a couple of programs that I think, you know, kind of tail this up. And one of them is the Law of the Sea Treaty that was signed by President Obama on behalf of the United States, that turned over literally all of the oceans to the United Nations for, determination on how the oceans would be used for fisheries and all the rest. Now, you know, if we're talking close to the United States, we're talking, out 5 miles, 6 miles out from the coastline.
Hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of oil exploration. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Gulf of Mexico and places like that. If the UN has total control of it, who knows what direction that's going to go.
Wow, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
I know here locally in North Carolina, I can't remember the exact date they're going to ban this, but there's a fish called the flounder, which you might be aware of. It's big sort of flat fish, yes. But they're about to ban all fishing of the flounder in North Carolina. And I don't know what the heck that's going to do for the fishing industry. I mean, I can kind of surmise what it'll probably do. And again, it's a conservation effort. I don't know how they're determining that the number of flounders off the North Carolina coast is down. But yeah, it's not even a size limit. It's just a flat out, you can't fish flounder anymore. I guess if you catch one, you got to throw it back.
Well, you know, that's just one more way that they can control us. And the thing that we need to understand is that the Asians eat, on average, about, 10 times the amount of fish that the Americans eat.
Mm-hmm.
If you go look at who are doing the major fisheries around the world, Japan, China, Vietnam, there's a bunch of Asian countries that are really at the center of a lot of these, fishing controversies.
Yeah.
I understand, I haven't seen it for a fact, but I understand that the Japanese are about to go back to hunting whales. Because the whale numbers have come back so strongly. Since we stopped the hunting of whales.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's amazing that the rules are set up for us, for free enterprise countries, but yet, somehow the other countries of the world, and especially the communist ones and the socialist ones, are given a free pass. Didn't make much sense to me. It really doesn't.
Not at all. It seems like we're succeeding in spite of everything else. Barely.
Yeah,
barely. I wanted to ask you, what was the Yucatan Peninsula piece of legislation you were talking about? Because I hadn't heard of that one. I was just going to write that down for my own.
Oh, yeah, write it down. It's capital Y.
Okay.
And then the number 2, and then another capital Y. It's the Yellowstone to Yukon initiative. But if you go back about 25, 30 years,
mm-hmm.
It was originally envisioned as the Yucatan to Yukon initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And when they rolled that baby out, it went all the way up through the United States, through a large part of Mexico, and then right up through the western states of the United States, literally all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the west, anything west of Colorado, and there was such an outcry that they decided they better rename it, retailer it to Yellowstone to Yukon. So look that one up, because that's a big deal. And this is one that I need it's one of the last ones on my list. But one that people need to be really aware of is the UN Indigenous Peoples Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Obama signed on to that as well. And under the UN Indigenous Peoples Treaty, and if you go and you actually look at the treaty itself and read it, the primary purpose of the UN Indigenous Peoples Treaty, it talks about how Indigenous peoples are much wiser in the use of the environment. I mean, we're talking Stone Age people, okay?
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
Well, of course they're wiser because there aren't many of them around, number one. And if you're using a stone axe, and keep in mind that the American Indian didn't even ride a horse until the Spaniards got here. And so, you know, they're out on foot. And there's a reason that, you know, that the Indian population in the continental United States was so low. And it was because they loved killing each other and enslaving one another.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't their own thought there be racist? They're trying to say that the indigenous people are somehow far better at maintaining the environment than us. I don't know.
The whole thing is just stupid because, you know, the fact is most indigenous people that they're talking about are from Stone Age cultures. And don't get me wrong. I have nothing against Native Americans or Aboriginals or any people at all, but the reality is I sure don't want to turn the control of our whole environmental program over to them. You know, I've sat through a few of these meetings with some of the Native Americans here in Montana as a county commissioner, and, you know, they talk about Brother Bear and Brother Wolf, and, you know, they talk about all these things that, you know, that they want to implement. And at the same time, you know, they drive there in a car, you know.
Exactly.
And all I can say is talk about hypocrisy on the highest level. You know, this is just insanity. We need to work together as people to produce the best economic and the best, let's say, personal result for humanity. And the only way we're going to do that is using a little bit of common sense, and certainly using the tools of a modern society to produce more wealth, more academic literacy, more science, more effort to improve on the use of our resources. You know, you take a look at what we've done over the last century. All these things that we produce, let's say automobiles are a perfect example.
Sure.
I was telling my daughter the other day, you know what the number one environmental concern in New York City in 1900 was? All the horse poop in the streets.
Yeah, because, and that's kind of what I was going to say myself. Yeah, I thought it might be horse and carriage fatalities or
absolutely
something.
I mean, the whole city stunk as a result of all the carriages and all the horses that were around in the street. It was a major concern and a major, you know, I would call it not just an environmental, but a social condition, because people didn't like the smell. They didn't like, you know, horses crapping and peeing all over the street.
Of course not.
You know, I can kind of understand that. Although apparently people in San Francisco haven't picked up on that.
Yeah, they just
now one of the problems they've got is people peeing and pooping in the streets.
Good grief, it's sad.
So,
yeah, to your point, in the cult of academia, when I get to teach this stuff at all, I always mention, you know, there's a big revisionist history going on with the Native Americans. You know, the communist model is they were all just happy, kumbaya, playing hacky sack and dancing around in a circle until those evil Spaniards got here. And, you know, I always say, well, you know, they were the ones doing the slavery, killing each other, making their own state-level societies. Like, all that was going on way before the Spaniards showed up, or Columbus in the West Indies or what have you.
Right, right. Well, and I think you and I would both admit there were some things that happened, you know, in the name of Christianity and the conversion of the Mayans and the Incas and, you know, some of the southern Indians of South America and Mexico.
Certainly.
Yeah, there were some things there, but take a look, too, at the fact that human sacrifice was one of the standards of most of those Inca and Aztec and Mayan cultures.
Absolutely. Nobody did it like the Aztecs.
Yeah. I mean, they love killing their own people, and sacrificing them to their gods, So I don't know. I mean, I'm not real crazy about the idea of Christians doing anything like that, but we certainly don't do that in the United States today. And, my Christianity is very much a Christianity of helping people and being a good servant,
True.
So anyway, but those indigenous people's treaties, John, I have to tell you.
Sure, let's talk about it.
One of the things at the very apex of those indigenous people's treaties, and it's stated in their own documents, is to return the native lands to the indigenous peoples that were there before white man came. Now, think about that, because, that's the entire United States. That's it's the entire North American continent and much of the rest of the world. And I have to tell you that I don't think that's smart stewardship. I think if you really care about the environment, you want to use the technology that we have at our disposal to create a clean and let's say an economically viable, but also environmentally and a culturally clean environment. And you're not going to do that with a poor country. Now, I'm going to use this statement because I use it when I do my lectures.
Sure.
If you want to see the very first attempts to create UN Agenda 21 and the kind of controlled society that takes a people and collectively puts them under government control and under the government system and handouts and all that, and what it will produce, go take a look at your typical Indian reservation.
Mm-hmm.
The government has been the primary provider of income and has told these people how they had to live. As early as the 1890s, the federal government were forcing these people to take their kids from their homes and go into government schools. And literally take them from an entirely natural, their native environment and control these people. They have been probably the most tightly controlled group of people overall in U.S. history. And I'm talking over the long, big brush look at this thing. And look at where they're at. It's a poor sector of the economy, even though with government grants and all the gambling and all the other stuff that's going on, there's enormous amounts of money being generated by the tribal leaders. But the tribal leaders take it all.
Mm-hmm.
And the average rank and file Native American, they live in squalor. They don't understand how important it is to create individual rights, because they've never had the right to do that. They really haven't. They've been under the government control. And then, of course, we introduced liquor to the reservations, and Native Americans had no natural, resistance to alcohol.
That's right.
And so alcoholism is the biggest problem in the world on a reservation now. There are so many things going on in this thing. It's a matter of connecting dots. And
I could not agree more. You were taking the words right out of my mouth. I was thinking the same thing before you mentioned it. I was thinking, you know, there's a big parallel here between what they want to do with us and what they've already done with the Native Americans. I mean, it's right there.
It's right there. It's right there. They took away, they gave them collective rights, but they took away their individual rights. And, you know, it's a, to me, it's a perfect demonstration of just exactly why private property is so important, to not only Americans, but to the entire world. There was a gentleman by the name of, Hernando de Soto, who wrote a, very compelling, very good book on capitalism and the importance of private property. And what he showed in his books and then through extensive research is that the poorest countries in the world are the countries that have the lowest private property ownership, and the countries that have the most wealth and have the most freedom are the countries that have the greatest respect and treat as a you know, a natural right, the right to own property. And it's how wealth is created. Wealth is created in the United States. 90% of all small businesses are started because they have the ability to leverage their private property. You know, they have mortgages or whatever on their property, and they have the right to use that as an instrument to borrow money to start a small business.
Yeah, I mean, that's right there. That's right there in your face. And, yep, I mean, the Native American model with the reservations, I mean, you can just look at the numbers. Everybody can for yourself. You got illegitimate children, you got high suicide rates, you got high drug rates, high incarceration rates, ridiculous numbers of diabetes, which, I mean, much like the folks coming from south of the border, I mean, biologically don't process the refined sugars like Europeans do. So it produces a higher obesity rate, and you got the higher diabetes. I mean, alcoholism, like you already mentioned, I mean, it's just beyond the veil.
The list just goes on. And, you know, I agree. There's some things that we need to learn from indigenous peoples. You know, certainly homeopathic medicine has a key ingredient there. You know, the fact that aspirin and a number of other different chemicals that are very, very good, very natural chemicals come from indigenous peoples' lore and legends, I think is terrific. You know, we need to learn from them. I have to tell you, forest management, and I'm somewhat of an expert on this. I'm one of only two people in the state of Montana that has received their forest stewardship master certificate. But I've worked with the Forest Stewardship Program in the state of Montana for the last, well, at least 10 years. Actually, it's, you know, close to 20 now. The Native Americans burned the forest. They were good stewards because they recognized that once in a while you needed to burn the forest to clear land so that the grass would come in and the you know, the wildlife would return. They were good about that, and they burned fairly small patches. They didn't, you know, just torch a whole forest. They knew how to take advantage of burning cover and canopy all in maybe 20 and 30 and 40 acre areas. And as a result, they didn't have the overgrowth and all the problems that we've got in forestry today. We need to learn from that. We need to take those examples. And, you know, right now the Forest Service, they've got a no-burn policy. Well, at least they did have. And now they've got a let-it-burn policy that leads to all these catastrophic forest fires, these these million-acre fires that we're having, these fires like we had in Southern California or Northern California and in parts of Montana and Oregon and Washington. You need to harvest good timber and use it. You know, this so-called carbon sequestration. I've got one of the most ideal carbon sequestration projects in my whole part of the country. Guess what that is?
What's that?
I've got a big log house. There's nothing any better in the world to sequester carbon than wood fiber.
Yeah.
And, you know, we build a log house here, and, you know, that's about as good as it gets, because you're getting a living environment that's quite attractive, and at the same time, you're sequestering carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're just common sense things that, of course, the environmental movement would never talk about. So, yeah.
Good grief. Well, I know you got to go soon. I was going to ask you before you go, what's your take on the new environmental princess of the moment, Greta, that's all over social media?
I have to tell you that, you know, it's amazing to me that, we have the kind of crazies, that are, you know, in charge of the dialogue. I mean, I don't know if you saw the film on that, but I believe she's the same one. Isn't she a trained actress?
I think, yes, sir. I believe so.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't she have, I've seen a video of it. She had the same rant when she was like 12 years old or something.
Yeah.
That's been recorded. And, you know, it's like, okay, we hire these actors and actresses to come in and testify and do these things. Good Lord, where in the world are we heading with this kind of nonsense?
I know. Kind of similar to the AOC thing. I mean, I've heard and read where she was basically selected to run because of her, you know, I don't know, appearance. And I guess that she could sway a lot of Latina votes. I don't know, but.
Well, I have to tell you, too, do you know that her district that she was elected with like a total of something like 18,000 votes,
mm-hmm.
because there's such a low voter turnout in her district that, I mean, almost anybody could have won it. But, you know, she's probably a pretty good little bartender, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, that isn't a qualification. And she supposedly has a degree in economics and... she didn't know that the Federal Reserve was a private organization. She knows less about economics. And I have to tell you this.
Sure.
We did a sound money bill in the state of Montana. A good friend of mine who is a legislator did a sound money bill. And what he was trying to do was bring gold and silver back into the state, not requiring people to trade in gold and silver,
mm-hmm.
but bring it back into the state as a legitimate money if people wanted to trade in gold and silver.
Sure.
And you know, not force anybody to do anything, but that way, if you decided to trade in gold and silver, you could. Well, this was a couple of years ago. This is a number of years back. And at the time, gold was trading around $325, $345 an ounce. Silver, I think at that time, was around $6. Anyway, he also, part of his bill is that he suggested that the state of Montana take the tobacco tax trust fund, which was about $50 million, and that they invest that in gold and silver to help fund the startup of converting, you know, the state back into a gold and silver state. Well, guess what? If we'd have done that, then we'd have been worth about five times the amount that we are today, you know, in the money that would be in that trust fund. And, but, oh, it was just, you know, talk about the liberals coming out of the woodwork.
Good grief. I can only imagine.
They just went nuts over this. Well, one of the guys that testified against the bill was a Montana legislator who was a retired college professor. He actually used the dean. He was retired as the dean of the School of Economics for the University of Montana over in Missoula.
Okay.
He was the dean of the college. He testified before the same committee that I testified before, and it was the administration, the administrative committee. Anyway, he testified before them, and one of the statements, and this is not an absolute quote, but it's really close, he said that no one was alive today that could remember when the United States was still on a gold standard. Now, this is a guy who taught our kids economics at the university level. Now, this was, let's just say it was 2008 or 2009 when we did this. It was back quite a ways. But then I got up and to testify, I said, this is exactly why our kids are economically illiterate. People like this are leading the university system. I said, we were on a gold standard internationally until Richard Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, September of 1971. I think there are probably quite a few people that are in this room that were alive when we had the gold standard. And that's the truth of it. The economic illiterates are the ones that are teaching our kids economics. They're teaching Keynesian economics instead of teaching our kids Austrian economics, or, you know, the fact that you can't just continue to print money forever and expect a good outcome.
Yeah,
now,
that's the truth.
I know that's pretty far-ranging. We're heading off in a lot of different directions.
No, I mean, I could talk all day about the cult of academia. It's so much
madness. Yeah, I know you
madness,
can.
You're, good Lord. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I've got a friend that has become a friend just recently by the name of Michael Rechtenwald. Do you know Michael?
I do not. It didn't ring a bell.
I am going to give you his contact information because he needs to be on your radio program.
Okay, that'd be terrific.
Michael is a now a former NYU professor. He was actually a tenured professor at NYU who admits openly that he was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And said that he taught as a communist, and he had classes on, social engineering and things like that. He was involved in academia at that level, and he started to question the efficacy of all this political correctness because he said it's destroying our right to have open and free discussion of things. And I think we've gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that publicly in the classrooms, and also he wrote a couple of articles about it. And his own administrative staff, the dean of the college that he was in the education department in, they called him in and they said, we think you've got some mental issues here.
Oh, man.
Yeah. We think maybe you're having a nervous breakdown. And they actually put him on administrative leave and mm-hmm. asked him to not go into the classrooms anymore. And they put him on administrative leave and they said, you know, you need to take some time and get your mind right. Well, guess what happened? Long story short, they forced him into an early retirement. Because he was tenured, they couldn't fire him. And so they forced him into an early retirement. And Michael is now one of the most avid anti-communists in the country. And he said, boy, I had an epiphany over a period of about 2 or 3 years and realized what in the world the education system was doing and what it was all about. And he wrote a book called Springtime for Snowflakes.
Oh, man, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But it's about his experience as a college professor and how they literally forced him into an early retirement because they said he was having emotional problems because he started to question political correctness and all the social engineering programs that were going on at NYU. So
I can't believe they at least gave him some retirement. That's amazing.
Well, I don't think they had a whole lot of choice.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm sure they would have preferred to give him nothing, but I think, you know, that's one of the things about academia, that as long as you're tenured and you know, you've had a good work record up to a certain point, they can't really do a whole lot about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's true.
And as long as he was a good commie, they were, you know, they were happy with him. So,
that's
but
what's
I,
so scary.
I will make sure that he, I'll make sure to send you his information because he would be a great interview. He's been on my radio program several times, and he does a really, really good interview.
Wow, that sounds terrific. Yeah, please do. Well, where can everyone find out more information about your program? How can they tune in? How can they at least follow what you're doing out there?
Well, they can go to redpillexpo.org, okay, and that they can go to redpilluniversity.org. They can go to Freedom Force International. That also is a website about that organization. I have a website that's got most of my radio programs archived on it called danhappel.com.
Okay.
And I'm just getting ready to start a new program this weekend with Patriot Soapbox Network. We're going to be doing a Sunday afternoon show, and that will be on the Patriot Soapbox Network. So,
okay. Well, that sounds terrific. If anyone missed that, fear not. We'll have all of Dan Happel's information under his guest media links, and we'll have, of course, this program and the video posted as well. So, as I always say at the end of every program, you can't do everything, but you can most certainly do something. So please check out all his work and all the other programs at AnomicAge.com. And we will see you next week for another riveting episode of The Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go get some more money.